Today on Maine Calling, organ donation in New England. In Maine, it's a little heart on your driver's license, the symbol that means you've checked the box to become an organ donor. But if you were in a fatal accident or died unexpectedly in another way, what would happen next? Does the system automatically kick into place? Who decides which organs and tissues to take, and who decides which patient will receive them? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will ask those questions and more about the organ donation system in New England. From practical information about what happens in the hospital to ethical questions about how organs are allocated. What does it mean to check the box? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Highland Green, an active 55-plus lifestyle community with a 230-acre nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
This is Maine Calling, and I'm Jennifer Rooks. It is probably not something you think about much, but organ donation can transform lives. We'll learn about the different sides of the equation, what goes into deciding to give an organ, and what happens when someone gets a life-saving organ transplant. Joining me for the hour, Alexandra Glazier, who is president and CEO of New England Donor Services, or NEDS, and Dr. Juan Palma, transplant surgeon with Maine Health's transplant program. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you chosen to be an organ donor? Do you wonder how the process works? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Alex and Juan, thank you so much for joining us today. Alexandra, I'll start with you. I understand that the country's organ donation system is a collection, a patchwork of nonprofit agencies, and that the one you head, New England Donor Services, serves all six New England states plus Bermuda. And you see organ donation by deceased donors. So we're not today talking about kidney transplants from live donors, but from those from deceased donors. Do I have that all correct?
Yes, you do. And good morning. Thank you so much for having me on today. So New England Donor Services is the nonprofit organization that is tasked by the federal government to serve all six of the New England states, and as you mentioned, also Bermuda. And we're responsible for coordinating all aspects of deceased organ donation in that service area. So that includes making sure that the opportunity for organ donation is identified, working with 230 hospitals in the service area. And then once that opportunity is identified, which by the way, starts with the hospital referring every death or imminent death, and there's certain clinical triggers for that, making sure that our organization is aware of that. We do an initial medical screen and then dispatch staff on site to the hospital to further work up that medical opportunity if it looks like organ donation is a potential. And let me just stop there for a minute and say, people might be surprised to hear that only a very small percent of deaths have any medical opportunity for organ donation. It's only about 2%. So it's a rare clinical circumstance where organ donation is possible.
I want to walk through those steps in just a minute. But before we do that, you announced a record number of organ transplants for 2025. What are those numbers?
Yeah, that's true. So in 2025, we had a record number of organ transplants from organ donors here in the region. It was nearly 1,700 life-saving organ transplants. And that was a record, an 8% increase over the prior year.
Okay. And from how many donors?
from 640 deceased donors.
Okay, so showing that one donor can provide life-saving organs to many people, up to eight, I understand, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So the impact is pretty substantial from one single donor.
Dr. Palmawan, what can you tell us about Maine's role in the organ donation system? What happens here, and when are patients sent out of state to Boston?
Hi, thanks, Jennifer, and thanks to your audience for having me. So the Maine Health Transport Program, has been operating since 1971. And so far, we have performed over 2,000 transplants. The Maine Health Transplant Program serves the population of the state of Maine and also northern New Hampshire. That's our catchment area. In terms of our participation in the transplant, I will call it process. The Maine Health Transplant Program, we basically list patients. We take care of the patients that we place on the list, and we collaborate with UNOS, which they have an algorithm that determines who gets the kidney first. And then, of course, Alex and the New England Donor Services, I mean, they provide the services that she already alluded to. So our participation in the process is basically to evaluate patients from Maine and northern New Hampshire, to help them to jump through the hoops, get them listed, and keep them ready to be transplanted when the time is up.
So. Okay. And Alexandra, how long are the waiting lists? How many people are there who need organ donations to survive?
So currently there are 108,000 plus patients waiting within the U.S. And here in New England, there are just under 6,000 patients waiting, of which about 400 are from Maine. So the need is great. And let me go back for a second and just address, I'm realizing you asked about the network of OPOs. So New England Donor Services, being an organ procurement organization, which we refer to as an OPO, and there are 55 OPOs across the country. We're community-based nonprofits that cover every pocket, every geographic corner of the country, and to ensure that the opportunity for organ donation is realized everywhere, so that every single hospital within the country works with a single OPO.
Dr. Palmas, walk us through what happens. Alex started a little bit. If someone comes into the emergency room, for example, and looks like he or she will not survive, what happens? Who assesses whether that person might be a candidate for organ donation? Oh, that's Alex.
I will let Alex. Yeah, I will let. Yeah, that's totally her field. And actually, they continue to improve upon what used to be the norm. And she can explain you better than I can do the system they have in place.
Sure.
Right, because one important piece of this is that the system of organ donation is set up as separate from the transplant programs. And so it does get a little complicated, but important to kind of keep those two pieces separate, that there are donor hospitals, which is every hospital in the U.S., and then there are special hospitals that are designated as transplant hospitals, which is what Dr. Palma is part of at Maine Medical Center. So OPOs, like New England Donor Services, are the ones responsible for all components of the deceased donor part. And then the organs are that are gifted from the donors are allocated to patients that are listed at the transplant hospitals and are then transplanted into the recipients who are waiting. So when a patient dies at a hospital, and this is the process I was beginning to explain, the hospital contacts the OPO that they're designated to work with. And here in New England, that's NEDS. And the NEDS staff does that initial screening to see if there's any medical opportunity for organ donation. And what are those criteria? Well, those are things like, is there active cancer or are there infectious disease that the donor, the potential donor has, that would be dangerous and unsafe for transplant into a recipient. That would rule out the medical opportunity for organ donation before we even get into whether the patient's registered or the family gives permission. So that first medical screen is part of what our organization does. If it looks like there's medical opportunity for organ donation, and again, that's a huge rate limiting factor. Only about 2% of patients that die in the hospital have medical opportunity for organ donation. If there is medical opportunity, then our staff from NEDS go on site. We check the donor registry to see if the patient has authorized organ donation themselves. And if not, then we're approaching the family for permission. And by the way, if they have registered as a donor, we're still approaching the family and talking to them about the fact that the patient has registered as a donor and what the process will involve. And then there's going to be a workup further to make sure, does the heart function, does the kidney function, does the liver function, which organs are suitable for transplant? And then there's a process of allocating those organs to patients like those listed at Maine Medical Center and elsewhere. And that's where the algorithm nationally comes into play, which patients are prioritized to receive. And by the way, also, they need to match blood type compatibility, size, and other factors like that are taken into account. Once the organs are allocated, it's the OPO, NEDS, that needs to arrange all of those logistical components. The surgical teams need to come in, the timing for the OR, and then the surgical recovery of the organs is coordinated. NEDS has a team of surgeons and also works with the surgical teams that are coming to receive the organs for the patient that accepted the organ for transplant. And all of this has to happen in critically short periods of time. The organs are then sent to the transplant recipient so that the organs go to the right patient at the right time. So you can imagine all of these components are relatively complex. They need to happen in relatively short periods of time. And so transplantation is one of those pieces of medicine that is pretty incredible that this happens on a daily basis, thousands of times here in New England throughout the year. Let alone nationwide.
All right. Well, I want to ask you all more about the system and the process in just a minute. But on the line right now is Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, who oversees the Department of Motor Vehicles. Shenna, thank you so much for calling, Secretary Bellows. For some people, checking off organ donor on their driver's license is a quick and easy decision. For others, it might give them pause. Explain why that choice is tied to having a driver's license.
We love this program, and you're hearing a lot about the need and about the process. And, you know, for all of your viewers or listeners who are thinking, gosh, maybe I do want to become an organ donor, we at the BMV try to make that as streamlined as possible. You just tell your BMV branch representative that you want the heart on your license, that you want to be an organ donor, and then that becomes a very visible symbol to anyone, you know, at the scene of an accident or at the hospital, that yes, indeed, this person signed up to be an organ donor. It's just a very visible, very clear way to identify who has signed up.
All right. And Secretary Bellows, what are the numbers? What percentage of people in Maine choose to be an organ donor?
Most Mainers do choose to have the heart on their license. Right now, it's at 54.6% of Mainers have that heart on their license. We're always trying to publicize it. Just last month in January, we had 17,994 new Mainers sign up to opt in to organ donation. And, you know, the impact is really extraordinary. In this work, I've had that opportunity to meet so many people whose lives have been saved or forever improved because of the generous gift of life from one organ donor. And so we just love this program at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. It's something that is easy for us to administer. It's easy and free for people who are going in to renew their license or get their license for the first time. They can make that generous choice to donate life.
And how does it work in the case of an emergency, like a fatal car accident? Do first responders in Maine check to see if somebody who has died or may die has organ donor on their driver's license?
So what I can speak to on our end is we'll get calls from the hospital and you know, the someone has tragically passed away, and the clock is ticking, and there's that possibility that they're an organ donor. And if that heart is on their license, we'll then do confirmation on the back end to provide all of the appropriate documentation and just reassure family members or survivors or loved ones, yes, this was the affirmative choice of this person on this day. And I think that that is something that gives families peace of mind in the most tragic, saddest day of their lives, perhaps. Their loved one is giving this gift of life and will live on in another and save another person's life.
Well, Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, thank you so much for calling in. Shenna Bellows, again, Maine Secretary of State. And Alex Glazier, just if somebody has that heart on their license plate, that is not the end of the story, right? It's really the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so first of all, a shout out to the secretary. She's been a huge supporter and champion of organ donation, and it's really made an impact. Maine leads New England in donor registration. And so I think that's an important fact for Mainers to know and to be proud of. But what I can say, because sometimes this is a myth that first responders see that heart on the license and maybe some implication that they would somehow do less to save a life in a trauma situation. And that's just simply not true. The heart on the license is a good indicator for the individual to know that their registration was effective. That's what that's for. On the back end, what happens is I mentioned that hospitals need to refer deaths to the OPO. That's when the registry is checked, and the registry is a web-based database. And that's where the legally binding mechanism exists. And so, and it's important to understand that there's a separation there between those that need to save a life, which are the first responders, and those responsible for organ donation, which is the OPO, and they're not involved until the patient has died. And that's a really important point to make so that we can hit head on that myth that somehow first responders might do less. In fact, it's important for organ donation that everything is done to save a life first, because those very efforts are what will ultimately help preserve the organs for organ donation if, in fact, the life can't be saved. So everything is aligned to save a life first. That's the priority.
Dr. Palma, Alex was talking about how this is complex. And one of the layers of complexity, isn't it, is whether or not a patient can receive an organ. And these decisions are being made very quickly. When you find out that there may be an organ available for one of your patients, how do you determine whether, and I'm not asking for medical, but how quickly do you need to determine whether that organ is a fit or whether the next person on the list needs to be the person who's contacted?
So it varies. It depends. Sometimes there is an electronic organ offer notification system that all transplant hospitals have access to. So in New England Donor Services has a donor. They enter all the donor information. The algorithm that is owned by the OPTN does the match run. And then you can see where your patient falls into the ranking category. This is done at the time of the offer. They specify at what time the donor is going to go to the OR. So those are more controlled cases when you may have anywhere from 12 hours up to 24, 36 hours to basically be sure that your patient is ready. That is one end. And then there is the opposite when some donors, and by the way, New England Donor Services is one of the leaders in the country in trying to facilitate and recover as many donor organs as possible. So they have some categories, which is expedite procurements. Patients are kind of that crashing. So they need to take them to the OR quickly to recover the organs. And obviously for those cases, the window that we have to reply is, within half hour to make the decision. But on our end, it is possible. I think that, the system works. Sometimes the geography, but that is nobody's fault. But sometimes for us, in some patients that due to the geography of Maine, patients in remote areas may not be, the timing may not be on their favor to get that specific organ. But we try to take advantage of the increasing number of donors that New England Donor Services has provided us through the years to capitalize and transplant as many patients in our list. By the way, what you mentioned about Shinavelos, the effort that they have done about increasing the organ donation signing into the driver license, that also, and I would like Alex to give us the numbers, is my understanding that as a result of that, Maine Health, Maine Medical Center is still one of the leaders as donor hospitals in New England. Is that correct, Alex?
Yeah, Maine Medical Center has always been a very strong champion of organ donation as well. And so a shout out to Maine Medical Center also for sure. And I think, as we have over the past several years really focused on increasing organ donations since 2020 in the region, organ donation has increased by 65% all around. And so other hospitals are reaching to catch up to Maine Medical Center, but Maine Medical Center is certainly remains one of the leading hospitals. And I think that what that speaks to really is that this is a true collaborative effort with, between the OPOs and the hospital and the donating public, which is really the start of all of it.
Well, so much more to explore, but we do need to take a quick break. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our show today is about organ donation, how the system works for deceased organ donation and matching those organs to recipients. My guests are Dr. Juan Palma, Maine Health transplant surgeon, and Alexandra Glazier, who is president and CEO of New England Donor Services. We invite you to join the conversation. Did you check off organ donor on your driver's license? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to an email from a colleague of ours at Maine Public. She writes, "In 2020, my husband was diagnosed with heart failure. It was unexpected and very scary. His mother had the same genetic condition, which unfortunately caused her passing. We were shocked and concerned when my husband was diagnosed with the same condition at such a young age. Over the past 5 years, he's had good and bad stretches of time with his health. This past year, more days than not, it was the latter. When he went to Maine Med in December and met with his cardiac care team, they were concerned about how poorly he was doing. After tests and blood work, he was transferred to Tufts in Boston and placed on the heart transplant list. In December, on December 29th, he received that transplant. We are very grateful for the teams and Maine Medical Center and Tufts for their fast-acting care that saved his life. A few things my family and I are navigating post-transplant is the home health care piece of the puzzle and finances. I would recommend that anyone going through a similar situation look into financial aid and assistance as soon as possible. The sooner you know an organ transplant is needed, the better. One organization that immediately stepped up to help us were the Heart Brothers. They are wonderful, as many of their volunteers are heart transplant recipients as well. Our friends, family, and my colleagues have been wonderful with making sure I was able to go back and forth to Boston while my husband was admitted at Tufts. We're incredibly grateful to those who supplied meals, assisted with travel, and helped with care for our son in those early weeks. There are still a lot of doctor's appointments and obstacles ahead, but at the end of the day, my husband has a new heart and a second chance at life. Our son has his dad, and I have my partner, and we all have a new outlook on what's truly important in the time we have. There are challenges to face on the road ahead, but we recognize that our family has been given the gift and opportunity to make new memories together and to find more joy along the way, for which we are grateful." So thank you, Allison, for that beautiful email. And Dr. Palma, I want to talk about one part of that, the challenge of getting the care you need after the transplant. Is this something that you hear often from your patients?
Unfortunately, yes. And that is, most transplant programs, we have as it should. Part of the multidisciplinary team, we have a financial advisor that meet with the patients from the get-go, try to be sure that, they have the right type of insurance. But as you know, with the ever-changing landscape of insurance, healthcare insurance in this country, it's extremely challenging to protect these patients, to get the medications they need and the care that they need. But again, we have professionals, I can speak for my program, that they do whatever it takes to meet the needs of the patients that we transplant, and even the ones that, we inherit from nearby programs, that, they come back to Maine to live. So we also help them in the transition. But it is something that I wish it was, that's the law of the land. We don't have universal health care, so we need to navigate all these financial hurdles with the patient. But I think that so far the results have been positive.
We're going to now listen to a voicemail we received from a listener ahead of this program.
More than a decade ago, my husband died suddenly in an accident, and we had all agreed that his organs would be donated, of which many, many were. Parts traveled far and wide. We had agreed to have the information about who we were and make it available for receivers to contact us. And despite so many parts of him going all over the world, I was never contacted by anyone. So my plea is, if you were a receiver of an organ or a part of some other human being, please, please drop a note to the family who suffered that loss, because hearing from them would give me great relief and comfort.
All right. Alex, is there a way in which people can contact a donor?
There is. I mean, hearing that is heartbreaking, because I think for so many donor families, all they want to know is that they helped somebody in need. They don't, they just want to know that they helped someone in need. And hearing that, and maybe hearing that thank you is all they need for turning that loss into healing. And so there is a way to do that. They can, for our organization, if the donation was through New England Donor Services, on our website, there is a way to request a connection. And there's a lot of different ways to connect. You can connect anonymously. You can connect in an identifiable way. Families meet all the time if both sides want to meet, and that can be facilitated easily. So I encourage recipients to do that, and to take a look on our website on instructions on how to easily make that connection, because the connection, the human connection, is profound, and it's a real privilege to do this work and to see that happen for the donor families.
Dr. Palma.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to echo Alex's words. You know, I'm also disturbed by the experience of this donor family, because I see that the patients that we transplant, and the majority of them through New England Donor Services, 8 out of 10 patients that I see post-op, they're extremely grateful, because this is a life-changing event, and they're always trying to, they ask information about how can they contact their donor families. And so we use New England Donor Services portal to basically just to guide the recipients to contact their donor families. I've been privy of donors, I mean, recipients telling us after a year or 6 months from their transplants that some of them, they've been able to meet the families, the donor families. And some of them, they have like a yearly reunions with the donor family. Where, so that is amazing that.
And let me just say, it's never too late and it's never too early. You know, any time is a good time. And the portal that Dr. Palmer is talking about is caringconnectionsneds.org.
All right. We're going to go to Robbie calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Robbie. Go ahead.
Hi, I really appreciate your show. I've had my license for 40 years with a donor sticker on it. But 20 years ago, I had occasion to be a live liver donor for my brother-in-law, who was able to survive until now. He's still alive. He was able to walk his daughter down the aisle for her wedding. So,
Yeah, Robbie, thank you.
Really,
Wow. Thank you for calling it. And Dr. Palma, I think I may have insinuated that only kidneys were live donor opportunities, even though today we really are focused on donations from deceased donors. What are the opportunities for live donation currently? What is possible for medicine today?
Yeah, the kidney takes the cake. I mean, it's the most common living donated organ, followed by liver. And then after that, you know, patients can donate. This is more like a controversial part of their pancreas, as an example. But liver and kidney takes the majority of the share in terms of providing organs from living donor sources.
All right. Thank you, Robbie, for your call. We'll go to Alan calling from York. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have an affiliation with both of these, your guests today. I've never met Alex Glazer, but my wife and I serve as volunteer ambassadors to the NEDS program and work with one of the motor vehicle bureaus to inform staff about what's going on within the program and to obviously celebrate certain fundraising periods that not at the Motor Vehicle Bureau, but to tell people that there are programs going on, like the annual walks that they have. So I'm really grateful to Alex and NEDS for what they do. It is a life-changing experience. And the reason why we know this is that my wife received a kidney transplant. Dr. Palmer was part of that team, and I can't thank them enough for the personal attention that they gave to my wife and to me. It continues some 8 years later. It continues to be a service where my wife is seen by a nephrologist in their office, generally speaking, every 3 to 6 months to check on her measurements and conditions and stuff. And so both of these individual guests and the focus on this program just remind me of how important transplants are, both in terms of deceased and also living donations. So I want to thank personally the two individuals, your two guests today. I want to thank you, and I just want to say how important it is for people to consider signing up at motor vehicle bureaus, at AAA offices across the state, across New England, to make this available. The fact that 2%, only 2% of the individuals who sign up end up being viable donators only means that we need a larger and larger pool of individuals.
Alan, thank you. Yeah, thank you for your volunteer work and thank you for calling today. Here's an email from Don. I have stage 4 metastatic prostate cancer. Can I still donate organs when the time comes? Also, I'm 78. Is there an age cutoff for donors? So, Alex, several people are asking about an age cutoff, and Don also asking specifically about his diagnosis with prostate cancer.
Well, it's a great question, and what we like to say is don't rule yourself out, because, frankly, the criteria change over time, and what was a rule out 10 years ago is no longer a rule out. And let me give you a very specific example of that, hepatitis. Hepatitis used to be a rule out because it was transmissible and deadly in recipients. But due to medical innovations, hepatitis is now treatable, if not curable. And so it's no longer a rule out. And so things change in medicine and in donation and transplant. And we hope that people sign up when they're young and stay donors and live long lives. And so we tell people not to rule themselves out. Currently, we assess potential organ donors well into their 80s. And that may continue to change and move up in time. So don't rule yourself out based on age. And in terms of cancer, currently active cancer would not be considered consistent with organ donation. But again, that's an assessment that should be made at the time of a death rather than someone ruling themselves out, because it may depend on specifics of a particular case. So don't rule yourself out.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We're talking about organ donation on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about organ donation today. With me, Alexandra Glazier with New England Donor Services and Maine Health transplant surgeon, Dr. Juan Palma. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Alex, I know that on a national level, a lot of the regulations are being changed. New rules are going into effect this summer. New England Donor Services is leading a lawsuit against some of these changes. What's going on that concerns you?
Yes, that's true. So there are new metrics that the federal government will be using to grade OPO performance in this 2026 year. And we feel, as do our colleagues across the country, that these measures are both inaccurate in terms of assessing performance and also highly disruptive to that network of nonprofit organizations, OPOs, that cover the country to ensure that we have a high performing system of organ donation here in the US. And so the metrics are inaccurate in terms of measuring OPO performance because they don't do things like risk adjust for the most common factors that of donors that impact the ability for the organs to be transplanted. Those are things like age, cause of death, underlying medical conditions that would impact the ability of organs to be transplanted. And then the government is planning to use these inaccurate grades to force the closure of up to half of the OPOs, the community-based nonprofits that do this work, which we believe will result in widespread disruption to this network overall. And we're quite concerned about this, as is the transplant community. The entire policy overlay here is driven, we believe, by a competitive market-based framework that the administration has put in place that we believe really truly just kind of misunderstands how organ donation takes place. This is a process that requires deep community engagement and understanding of the public that we're serving. Mm-hmm. And that's what's at the core of organ donation. So we're quite concerned about this, although I do want to assure the people of Maine and New England that NEDS is not at risk of being decertified or being closed, but we do think that the service area itself throughout the country is at risk for significant disruption. And so, right, as you mentioned, we are part of a lawsuit.
And when you say OPO, again, that's Organ Procurement Organization, right?
Correct.
Okay, correct. Great. We'll go to Torbert in York. Hi, Torbert, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. If you could be quick, that'd be great. We have so many calls coming in. Are you there, Torbert?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead quickly, please.
Yes. All power and love to your guest. It's a miracle that they perform, and it's a wonder that it's all being done voluntarily. Unfortunately, for every good human activity, there's a shadow that it already is showing up through this administration about market-based. In Russia and China, they don't worry about organs. They got a huge prison population that they dip into when they can have need. And in India, in the capitalist way, there are whole villages where all the women have only one kidney. Is there some role for regulation by the Congress in which money is procured? Because that seems to be another hidden thing that's going to evolve in the market system so only the rich get organ donations.
Torbert, thanks for your question. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a couple things to say about that. First of all, it's important for the public to know, you know, that it is illegal both, and it's a crime federally and at the state level to buy or sell organs in the U.S., period. And also that our allocation system does not take into account social status in any way. Every single organ allocation is audited as it should be, as it should be, and that it's medical criteria that's utilized to allocate organs. But certainly you mentioned, you know, that other countries do activities that we find, you know, unethical and are illegal here. And these are the things that we should be concerned about and stay vigilant to make sure our system of organ donation is based on ethical principles that are not market-based and are grounded in a nonprofit voluntary system.
And Alex, how is that enforced? What are the checks and balances there?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, it's criminal, both at the federal level and at the state. There's oversight at multiple layers of oversight for organ donation and transplant, both at for OPOs, donor hospitals, and transplant programs. And I also mentioned that every single organ allocation is audited. And if it is not in compliance, then that is investigated, as it should be.
All right, Torbert, thanks.
I would like to add just quickly, similar to what Alex, New England Donor Services do, because we also remember there's also living donation. We also have some guardrails. We have an ombudsman, an independent living donor advocate that checks precisely the intention, the motivation to donate, to be sure that, there is no, you know, money exchange for the prospective living donor or organ donor to donate. So we have the same system on our end, precisely because it's illegal to do that thing in the U.S.
Okay. Thank you. Jane on Facebook writes, when my dad died at 81, the skin on the backs of his knees was all he had to offer, but we were happy to know that someone got a skin graft. Don't rule yourself out. Jane, thank you for sharing that.
And Dr. Palma, go ahead. Sorry. I was just going to say, it raises an excellent point. We've been talking about organs, but tissue donation is a significant need. You're far more likely to need a tissue transplant than an organ transplant. This is things like skin grafts, bone grafts, cornea transplants. And there are millions of tissue transplants that take place annually in the U.S. And tissue donation is a much more likely option at the time of death than organ donation because of the medical criteria are different. And the age criteria are longer. And so this is a great example.
And Dr. Palma, it looked like you wanted to jump in.
No. I'm okay.
Okay, terrific. Let's see here. We will go to Mitch calling from Lisbon Falls. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you. So I have just a quick comment and maybe a follow-up question that we take off air. When my stepdad died many years ago, in the spirit of yesterday's show, seems like yesterday, but it was like 27 years ago, he was an organ donor. He was very proud of having that on there, and he died. He was under 60 years old. My mom was very proud that he wanted to do it, and so things were taken. She knew that the process was being taken care of, and when... rather than just get a letter of thanks from New England, from the organization, and I think even American Heart might have sent one as well, she got a letter that basically was very kind of abrupt about, we're sorry, but we can't use any of your organs. And we weren't able to use any of those kind of things. And at the time, I wrote a letter saying that maybe it could be a softer, more compassionate response when you can't have... When the organs can't be used. My mother was pretty upset about that because it just seemed like it was like, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And my feeling was, you know, can we just do no news is, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all kind of thing. And just thank the family.
Yeah.
Has that been changed up at all? I'm just curious. I haven't had any other opportunity since then to be involved in that.
Alex, has that changed?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry for that experience. So that's unfortunate. I think, keep in mind, families do want to know whether the donation took place or not. So
Right.
it is important to inform families whether organs were removed or tissues that were authorized to be gifted were removed or not. So it is still the practice and, in fact, required to let families know whether authorized gifts were recovered or not. I do hope that you would find our communications empathetic, and not cold. So I would like to say our practice has changed. If it was a letter from our organization, I'm not clear that it was.
Okay.
Yeah, there was
Mitch,
one
thank
from,
you.
it was from either yours or predecessor, but it's fine. And I just think maybe even to take a look at it and just like, how would I feel if I got this, the way it's worded or something. I don't know, but.
Right.
Yeah, Mitch, thank you for your call. I want to ask a question. I suspect, Alex, you're the right person to answer this. We were talking at the beginning of the program about what happens if or what happens when. And I want to go back to that moment, whether you're in the emergency room or something like that. You were talking about that a transplant surgeon from NEDS would need to come up to Maine. How long does that usually take? And when that happens, does the person need to be kept on life support?
So it depends is probably the best answer I can give you. NEDS has a team of surgeons, and also we work with the surgeons in Maine, and also sometimes there's surgeons coming from other transplant programs to do the surgical recovery, for example, of a donated heart or maybe a donated lungs or a donated liver, so that they can bring the organ back directly for the patient for whom it's going to be transplanted into. So, as you can appreciate, donation process is highly complex and each case is somewhat unique in terms of the compilation of surgeons that might come for those particular organs. You ask about whether the patient is going to remain on ventilated support. And the reason why that also depends is because there are two pathways clinically that can occur with organ donation. In one, the patient has been declared brain dead and they remain on a ventilator after they've been declared and during the process. The other is called DCD, or donation after cardiac death. And that is where the patient has not been declared brain dead, but the family, together with the care team, has decided to withdraw ventilator support. And after the withdrawal, the patient passes away and is declared dead. And then organ donation proceeds, and the patient is not on the ventilator during that process.
And is
So
the
those are two
family
different
in those two
circumstances.
processes, is the family able to be with their loved one when that person passes?
So the family is with the patient at the time that brain death is declared. Presumably, they can be. And for a DCD process, the patient can be there at the time that the ventilator is withdrawn and death is declared. But in both of those instances, the family is not there at the time of organ donation.
We'll go to Steve calling from Bar Harbor. Steve, we're really tight on time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Hi, Jennifer. Important program. The list of organs that can be gained from living donors, you mentioned kidneys and livers and tissues, but don't forget about stem cells for blood cancers. So peripheral stem cell transplant and also bone marrow transplants are pretty easy for living donors, and they saved my life, and they'll save a lot more.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Palma.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to thank Steve, and he's absolutely right. Obviously, most of the donation in this country is from deceased donors, but also we like to remind your audience that all living donors can be also part of the change. Particularly for liver and kidneys, same we have the same platform that New England Donor Services has. I mean, we have a website that donors can register themselves is mmcdonorscreen.org. If they are interested in to learn about organ donation, we welcome them to provide us their information, and we'll contact them and see if living donation is appropriate for them or not.
Steve, thank you for your call. And even though we have so many more questions, it's going to have to be the last one. I apologize to everyone who's not able to have their questions answered. Thank you both for joining us today. Alexander Glazier is the president and CEO of New England Donor Services, and Dr. Juan Palma, a surgeon with Maine Health's transplant program. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the dangers of cybercrime, some recent examples right here in Maine, and how to stay safe. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.